Hello, Brooklyn, how you doing? Where you going? We cannot come to. And if I can, I'm gonna be your man. You can be my lady and have my baby and drive my car. You got me crazy. So however you going, baby, you going? Just take me, cause I'm so taken. Hello, Nets fans. How ya doing? This is the Russell and Fro podcast. Russell here, Fro there, with your hosts, Carl the Talent Jackson, Brett the Man Bun Garofalo. Initial impressions of the James Harden era and MVP frontrunner Colin Sexton abound this evening, but you know this, we can't begin a hot potty without asking our co-host, Carl. How are you on this late Wednesday evening?
Better now that I've heard the phrase hot potty. Brett, I had a wonderful day today. First day of the rest of my life, I think, very much in many ways. I was washing dishes after dinner, cleaning up while my wife gave my son a bath, and just thinking, this is great. I'm going to watch the Nets because coming off of Monday night's game against the Bucks, that's one of the most fun regular season basketball games I've watched in years. And I was like, we got the Nets game tonight. And I was like, it's probably not going to be a great game. And boy, did they over deliver on that front. Even before, frankly, like the Colin Sexton second overtime, I'm not even mad. It's just absurd. Like, there'll be a lot of things I think we're going to talk about today in terms of what the offense is going to look like. And is the defense going to be good enough? And you're also just going to have moments like that where just, Colin Sexton just goes inferno. And I don't really think the Nets are playing particularly bad defense on him. And whatever. I think there's plenty that we can talk about earlier in the game. Because it was, I named this recording the Cleveland Steamer because that's what that one really felt like. We don't need to get too graphic about it. But hey, listen, all in all, good day. Glad to see Kyrie back out there. I don't think we really plan to talk about the Kyrie off-court stuff too much. What I would just say in terms of my thoughts, and I tweeted this out, Christian Winfield had just an absolutely incredible article in the Daily News today, just kind of summarizing the whole thing. I thought it was, in a debate that's just been so ham-fisted and stupid and exhausting, I just thought he was really nuanced and took time to, understand Kyrie as a human, and also look at it from the professional angle and understand sort of where those things intersect and multiple things being true at the same time. And I would just refer everybody to that in terms of some great thoughts there. And it was good to see him back on the court, I think, especially after that press conference, definitely rooting for him. I hope he finds his joy on the or some joy on the basketball court. Cause it didn't 100% seem like that was back for him today, but hopefully he can get there soon.
You can see why fans of Kyrie Irving get so frustrated, though, because one thing I've learned rooting for him these past 2 years is that his haters wait until these moments and then they pounce. I have folks that I don't talk to about basketball for entire seasons, that the second something has gone wrong with Kyrie, I'm getting a text about, is he going to retire? Are we never going to get him back? I was really hoping this wouldn't happen to you, man. Okay. All right, we get it. You don't like Kyrie Irving. You're waiting for these moments to voice your displeasure. Whatever.
And Brett, I know that you're currently in Texas, but where did you live before that?
I lived in Boston, Carl, a city knows our guy Kai.
That's odd.
Well,
it's weird that you get those texts with that former forwarding address. So anyway, like I said, I don't think we really want to focus on that angle. But what we do want to focus on today, I think, is looking at, I think, just more broadly, the narratives around this team coming off the Harden trade, what we think about them. And then I think, that'll segue a little bit into sort of logical next steps and moves that this team is going to have to make. So I guess let's just start right there. I mean, to me, there have been two pretty resounding narratives that, have come up with this team. And I will sort of distill them down to their dumbest form. And then we can talk about sort of what, you know, actually make sense underneath them. But number one is the classic, there's only one ball, which, you know, is not really all that revolutionary to be pointing out about a basketball court. You know, might be more interesting if it was a scrotum, but that's a different story. And then the second one is mew, but their defense, or as Nick Wright, I think, most obnoxiously put it, these guys would dominate the league if they were playing make it, take it. Thank you, sir. I would not like another. So which one of those do you want to start with? Do you want to start with one ball, or do you want to start with defense?
Let's start with the law of diminishing returns. There's only one basketball.
Very good. Very good. So thank you for bringing that piece up. I think there are two sort of smart underlying critiques underneath the one ball umbrella, which are, you know, number one, there's some diminishing returns when you're adding, you know, obviously we've seen how well this team can run with Kyrie and KD, and we've seen how well it can run with KD and James Harden. What kind of value do you get with all three of them? You know, coming in together, and that's fair. I mean, I think, you know, on the season before this game, the Nets had a 114.7 offensive rating, which is good for fourth in the league, 109.6 defensive rating, which is good for 15th, middle of the pack. You know, with just KD and Kyrie through January 5th, they were at a 113.5, which was fifth in offensive rating, would be seventh on the overall season, and a 105.7 defensive rating, which was eighth, would be tied for third on the season. So a little bit better defensively, but the league was also, you know, a little bit better over that stretch. I think teams were taking some time to get warmed up. And then with Harden, just the two-game sample before today, 118.2 offensive rating, which would be first by far and away on the season, although it was actually fourth over that two-game stretch, and 114.4 defensive rating, which would be tied for 29th on the season, because the motherfucking Sacramento Kings have 120.5 defensive rating on the year, which, good Lord, I don't know what's going on there. So, you know.
Luke Walton, still employed.
That's true. You know, point of all of that being just that, you know, this is a team that has already been succeeding by, you know, really bumping up their offensive production and has struggled on defense. You know, adding Kyrie to the mix on top of Harden and on top of Durant really, you know, adds to your strength, but how much more is that going to push the ceiling and takes away from your weakness. So that's I think smart thing number one. And then, you know, smart thing number two is the question of, you know, can we get actual buy-in from these guys in reduced roles? So I think basketball fit wise, like, I don't really think that there's a ton of it or a huge issue with these guys playing together. And we can talk about that, but I think mentally and focus wise, and today's game, you know, I wouldn't read too much into it, 'cause I think today's game was just sort of a stink bomb, but, you know, kind of goes to show you, like, if they're not, you know, if everybody's not engaged, what types of things can happen. So I guess like let's start there. I mean, do you have thoughts on either the sort of buy-in angle or the diminishing return specifically?
I do. I have a lot of thoughts on it, because we're going to be forced into many positions to defend ourselves and our team as Nets fans. And Carl, we got to be ready, but luckily we're here for the people. I would say this: when folks say things like there's only one ball, that assumes that the second the basketball leaves Kyrie Irving, James Harden, or Kevin Durant's very capable hands, that player disappears, magically apparates on the court. There's nobody there. And then when a shot either goes in or misses and the other team gets the ball, they magically reappear on the court to be made fun of and have their highlights when they don't try in a defensive possession cherry-picked for SportsCenter on one of those daytime shows and then replayed on my Instagram feed, because I've watched too many of those Stephen A. Smith yelling about the Nets clips. Listen, when you don't have the ball, you are still valuable. And these players are still valuable. You have to guard James Harden. You have to guard Kevin Durant. You have to guard Kyrie Irving. They are some of the best shooters in the league. So even if they are simply standing there with their knees slightly bent and there is a 1% chance that they might shoot the ball, if it comes to them, the defense has to stretch out and has to give whoever they've just passed the ball to room to drive. So even if there's no offense and they're standing there and they're resting for the next defensive possession, they are still providing gravity and stretching the floor. Now, the flip side of the argument is none of these players know how to play off ball, and because of that, their value is diminished as a standing-in-place gravity guy. I do buy that, and that's where we get into the crux of the argument where, okay, if these guys are going to continue playing 56 minutes a game, and our bench is going to produce negative 17, negative 54, whatever terrible net rating you want to throw out there until we make some moves on the margin or Tyler Johnson comes back and saves us, those possessions are going to continue like that. Where when they are off ball and they do have to be bought in on the defensive end, they're either going to rest on defense so they can play offense or rest on offense so they can play defense. So there has to be – there's a couple things I believe that need to go into getting more buy-in from the Nets stars off ball. And that comes with Steve Nash and the coaching staff feeling comfortable that we're not going to blow games by playing the bench more than 5 to 10 minutes. So those are a few thoughts. I could ramble on for a bit, but what do you think about that?
Yeah, I think it's interesting. You know, part of what I think is important to remember is, you know, these guys are playing together essentially without really practicing, right? So the offense that they're running is fairly simplistic. I think, you know, with what we've seen from the Rockets, you know, in D'Antoni and Harden's time there, you know, their offense was fairly simplistic already. So that's fine. Like, I don't think they need to be running, you know, some complicated, like Pete Carril, Princeton style, you know, backdoor cutting, you know, difficult, complex offense. But I do think that, you know, the more sort of little wrinkles they can fold in there, the easier it'll be. And I did feel a little bit today, like, you know, again, you don't want to read too much into the one game because of just, you know, just felt like they were a little bit flat. I do feel like adding the additional, you know, with the additional add of Kyrie to Harden and Durant when they're all on the floor at the same time, you know, there's going to need to be an adjustment period, I think, for them to get used to sort of what it means to play off ball. I think, you know, you see, like, with somebody like Joe Harris, who I think is just like a little bit more of a natural fit. I think you saw in that Bucks game, you know, for instance, like the little pistol action that he'll run with Harden, where, you know, they're basically having Harris come up and set a screen for Harden, you know, maybe 10 or 15 feet before the 3-point line. And, you know, he's able to leak out off a roll off of that when a hard double comes to Harden and, you know, was getting open threes and was making them. You know, I think those types of little wrinkles, it seemed like they needed a little bit more time to work out. But it also just felt like they just missed shots today that they normally would make. And I think the one glimpse that I found of the sort of amazingness of what this offense could be was on a play down the stretch in the fourth quarter where I want to say KD drive, kicked it out, and just like swinging it around the arc from, you know, Jeff Green, who I think has proved to be a fairly capable 3-point threat as like your small ball center, you know, out to James Harden, out to Kyrie Irving, and then around to Joe Harris, like making all the extra pass, and Joe was just completely, you know, butt naked, wide open, and ended up missing the shot. But I think that kind of goes to show you the types of things they can do. To put, you know, like I felt like against the Bucks, you know, Durant was able to get into his stuff pretty easily. I think Harden was able to get into his stuff pretty easily. I think, you know, as they kind of stream everybody back in, that'll start happening. And, you know, you put Joe Harris in a position where, you know, he's now getting guarded by your fourth best defender and is able to do enough in addition to his 3-point shooting that, you know, while he's not obviously on the same superstar level as those other three guys, you know, he can certainly take advantage of defensive matchups and just become kind of a nightmare for other teams on defense. So I think it'll come. I think it'll take a little while to figure out sort of those roles. And I guess that's another thing that I wanted to kind of ask you about is like, what do you see sort of the ideal, like the platonic ideal for this team being? Is it more set in terms of roles? Like, you know, Harden is the primary facilitator and Kyrie's primarily playing off ball and KD's sort of, I guess, continuing the same role he's in, or you know, do you see it different than that, or what's your thought?
It's interesting. And I thought you were going to ask me about Buck Naked Joe off the hard double in Sexland, but we'll go down this path first.
Sometimes when you come to Sexland, you leave with a burn, you get burned. And I think we left Sexland with a burning sensation that the doctor says will clear up. You know, we got to take our medication.
And we just had sex tonight too. That was it.
Yeah, we got fucked.
We're going to have to cut that.
We won't cut it.
We never do. I go back and forth on what's more important, because I think during the regular season we could really string together a ton of wins and some incredible offensive efficiency with a strong staggering lineup and really, really figuring out what iterations of the lineup Harden and Kyrie play best with, Harden and Durant play best with, Durant and Kyrie, one of those players on the court, none of those players on the court, you name it. And I think that is important, because there will be stretches during our most meaningful games where we won't have all three on the court, we might not have any of them on the court. But finding the most optimal way to get all three of those guys and Joe Harris to play well together is going to be the most important thing, because we have to figure out the last 5 minutes of games. I think right now we are scraping by on, at least in a game like tonight, we prove that we can scrape by on minimal effort. Whatever player happens to be closest to the inbounder after a missed or made shot, well, if it's an inbounder, be a made shot, they throw it over to him. That person takes it up. Hell, it can even be Jeff Green. Whoever's open at the top of the key, okay, let's get it over to Harden, Durant, have that person initiate the offense, and we'll see if we can get a good shot from that. And that's all well and good. But when it comes down to crunch time in the end of the game, that's where the Nets have struggled a little bit, and that's where we really need to press the issue and figure out what wrinkles work best. So I do see us staggering, of course, but they're going to need to really, really focus in on some quality minutes with those guys all out there together to figure out what wrinkles work best in the half court for us, which isn't like, it's not going to be a struggle to draw plays and really figure out what works best for the team, but I just think we're going to need to get those reps and get those minutes. And without practice, these games are going to be like practice for us, because hey, we're saying, oh, the Nets haven't practiced, they're finally going to have some time to do that. Half of these guys are recovering from injuries. It's going to be a condensed season regardless. We might not get that much practice, so these games are going to be like practices for us. And quite frankly, tonight's game seemed like that. And I think we're fortunately or unfortunately going to see a lot more of that. And because of sheer talent alone, we're still going to be in these things at the end.
Yeah, no, I think that's fair. And I think you make a good point in terms of sort of the game kind of becoming the laboratory where you experiment with these types of things. The way that I would sort of break it down or kind of foresee it happening is like, I think you'll see a little bit of a rollout in terms of where the Nets improve, right? Like, I think the initial step is going to be kind of figuring out the minute stagger. And, you know, as Steve Nash, do you try to keep two of these guys on the floor at all times? Or, you know, are you better off going down to one and bringing more of a bench mob situation in? You know, I think Cleveland in particular is a little bit funky in terms of matchups, because they have about 15 centers. Like Larry Nance, you know, essentially is their small forward, even though he's really like a small ball five. I think that's why you saw TLC tonight more than Bruce Brown, in addition to sort of Kyrie obviously like eating some of that minute share. So I think they'll need to calibrate a little bit there. And so I think that's sort of step one, right? Is just like, let's figure out that stagger. Let's get to that, to your point, like that regular season optimization, I guess, where, you know, you can win games because you're just beating the snot out of the other team's bench because you have, you know, James Harden running, you know, a bench unit against them. And that, and the bench unit, frankly, like, isn't all that bad, particularly if you're gonna have like Joe Harris come off the bench. You know, I don't know if that'll continue or not, but like, you know, bring him in as a shooter, you know, maybe Landry Shamet continues to play well, Bruce Brown, you know, bringing energy, et cetera. Like, you know, that's, I think, step one. And then step two is, you know, to your point, what's the closing lineup and how do you find the, for lack of a less business douchey term, synergy between Harden, Durant, and Irving to the point where, you know, you're really honing in on them as a closing lineup and figuring out a way to just punish teams by like shooting the piss out of the ball.
I'll have you know that connective tissue has replaced synergy as the new business colloquialism that's going to drive everybody crazy. So prepare yourself for that.
Very good.
I think here's the point that I was trying to get to. We can't simply figure out what our closing lineup is at the end of games due to what I think is going to be a severe lack of practice. I think we're going to have to pick out other times during the game. Maybe it's the last couple minutes of the first half, you name it, where we have that lineup out there and experiment with it. And I'm going to be interested to see when we have DeAndre Jordan in our closing lineup and when we don't. Because Jeff Green certainly adds a new wrinkle to that lineup and gives us an option where every player on the floor can bring the ball up and shoot from three. But that's not going to work against a lot of the lineups we can expect to see if we make a deep playoff run, thinking about Philly, thinking about maybe the Bucks, thinking about the Bucks, thinking about the Lakers. Maybe we'll see the Nuggets. Like how are we, like, we're going to try to run them out of the gym in the last 5 minutes. There aren't going to be a lot of transition points then. So I just think we're going to need to find other ways to insert those closing lineups into meaningful minutes.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one question, and I'm jumping around on our outline a little bit, but like, the obvious answer is Irving, Harden, Joe Harris, Kevin Durant, and a center-like object, whether that's Jeff. I mean, for me right now, it's probably Jeff Green. There could be certain situations, I suppose, where it's DeAndre Jordan. I mean, it was DeAndre Jordan in the box game, although Kyrie wasn't playing. Like, but is that foursome that Kyrie, James Harden, Joe Harris, Durant, like, do you feel like, obviously, sort of, they're going to need time and blah, 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 blah. But, like, do you feel like that's viable just from where we sit right now?
Let me put it this way. I think that Kyrie Irving, James Harden, Kevin Durant is viable based on where we sit right now. And as much as I love Joe Harris, I think you can insert, especially if you're putting Jeff Green in there and you have a little bit more offensive skill on the table, you could throw somebody like a Bruce Brown in the closing lineup if you wanted more defense, and I don't think much would come off the table. Or you could throw a Luawo Cabarrón if you think that he has a better defensive matchup than Joe Harris. It's crazy to say that he's a little bit more interchangeable, but I think having those three and a Jeff Green out there allows you to throw a less skilled, less gravity guy on the floor that might elevate the defense a little bit. But I think that Jeff Green's our best guy.
Do you feel like they're better off doing that with, like, I mean, just like right now, like, you know, Friday's game, like, do you think that they're better off from a do you feel like the gap is, I mean, the gap is large enough between Brown and Harris or between TLC and Harris that it would be worth sitting in?
I could see it with Brown. I could, especially if we're up against a guard-heavy lineup where somebody's lighting us up. Like, for example, the end of the game tonight, maybe things turn out differently if we've got Bruce Brown guarding Colin Sexton on some of those possessions. I'm not saying that Kyrie Irving didn't do a good job. He was competing every single possession, but it became clear that was the matchup that they wanted, and they thought that if they had a player of Colin Sexton's caliber taking shots against Kyrie Irving, that was going to be their best offense down the stretch. So much so that they weren't even running picks for him. So I think that we're going to be forced into that type of situation, especially in the playoffs, where we're going to need to have somebody that's out on that perimeter wreaking havoc so somebody doesn't step on the court with that confidence and then they can just step into their shot whenever they want. So I don't know if it's necessarily, I don't know. I think it helps Kyrie the most, because I think that he's going to be, he and DeAndre Jordan are going to be the two most hunted players in our lineup. And if you're playing Jeff Green as a small ball five, all of that focus is going to come on Kyrie. And that takes the pressure off of him.
Yeah, that makes sense. That's interesting. I didn't necessarily feel like tonight specifically was about them hunting Kyrie so much as it was just Sexton got hot. I think Durant was actually guarding him on a couple of those possessions off of a switch, maybe, or at least was the primary contester of his shots. So, I buy it. It's interesting to me. I think you lose something on offense by having Bruce Brown or TLC out there, who I think just immediately become the guy that you leave alone, which breaks, I think, a little bit of what this, I mean, because I do feel like part of what this offense is doing, I mean, partially maybe the answer is it doesn't matter because the floor is so high when you have guys that can, you know, guys at the caliber of Kyrie Irving, James Harden, and Kevin Durant that are creating the shots themselves. Like, even if it's just them playing iso ball, like, you're probably, you know, in a good spot. And so how low can you really sink? I do think that there's something to, like, putting Harris out there and forcing defenses to just have to literally, like, having five guys on the floor that are a threat at all times, like, I think opens things up in a way that is, I think, important, but maybe it's not. So, you know, that'll be something to watch, I think, you know, as we move down the stretch. And I guess, like, in my opinion, like, just in terms of the sort of the roles that we've seen these guys play, I mean, I think Durant's role is pretty solidified, right? Like, you know, he's going to be off ball more often than not. He'll still sort of initiate actions when they're pushing in transition. And, you know, occasionally they'll run stuff for him up top, but I think he is the most comfortable off ball of all of these guys. They'll work him out of the post. Like, I don't really think his really anything changes about his role from what he's already been doing. And then I think between Harden and Kyrie, like, I think, you know, they're the most redundant of this group. I think Harden has shown, at least initially, to be a little bit more willing as a passer. And I think he's just a little bit more effective as a passer. So I kind of like him in more of the primary initiator role with Kyrie doing some more off ball stuff. You had made a comment to me. So that's sort of my kind of initial thought on just the roles. You had made a comment to me a couple weeks ago that I want to go back to, and I'm putting you on the spot a little bit, but, and it was sort of around, like, early in the season when that conversation around Steph Curry was kind of brewing, and like, oh, how could Steph Curry be, you know, considered one of the, you know, the greatest players in the NBA right now if, you know, he's, you know, the Warriors are so terrible, with, you know, with him still being on the floor. And, you know, kind of getting into the discussion of, like, well, there's a difference between sort of floor raisers and ceiling raisers. And, you know, Curry is somebody who's, like, perhaps the greatest ceiling raiser of all time. And you said to me that you thought that Kyrie Irving is an elite ceiling raiser in that regard. Can you talk a little bit about your thought there and how you think that fits in with this discussion, or if you think that fits in with this discussion?
Yeah, I can definitely talk about that, because I think that's a fascinating discussion and one that you can really only have if you root for a team like the Nets. So I would love to have this discussion over and over and over again, because we may never have a team like this again. I think I just want to address, going back to my previous point, that I think if you're having Kai, James, and KD on the court, then you can really play anybody else, and you're going to be able to get a bucket down the stretch once they figure out the off-ball stuff, and it's not just your turn, my turn. And I think that's why I would default to what gives us the best chance defensively, unless the matchup proves otherwise going down the stretch. So I think that's what I was thinking about there. I think the hit to the offense is is less than the boost to the defense by inserting somebody like Bruce Brown or player X that we pick off the waiver wire. But let me answer your question about Steph Curry and Kyrie Irving. I think Kyrie, as somebody said it the other day, and I can't quite remember, and you referenced it earlier, where you were saying, hey, great players are guys that take shots that the defense wants them to take, but hits them at a high enough rate that their team is elite offensively anyway. So you think about Chris Paul being one of the best mid-range shooters of all time, Michael Jordan, Dirk Nowitzki, these turnaround fadeaways in the post over two defenders. That's a shot that any defense would be happy forcing a player into, but they hit them at such a high clip that they are some of the best offensive players of all time, and they have made deep playoff runs, and one is the best player of all time. So Kyrie Irving definitely fits into that, but he is not quite at that level of one of the like top 10, 25 players of all time. But he does shine towards the end of games, and that's where I see him as a ceiling raiser. Yeah, he might take some contested shots during a game that are suboptimal and don't have the level of efficiency that you would want. I'm thinking specifically about some of those turnaround long two fadeaways when you look around and you've got Kevin Durant, James Harden, and Joe Harris surrounding you. Not necessarily a shot that you want one of your best offensive players taking, when it would be so easy to work and get a much more higher efficiency shot. But as you're looking at the end of games and you're up against the most elite defenses, having a player like Kyrie Irving that, in my opinion, and from what I've seen, can break down anybody, throw any defender at him, he's going to be able to break him down off of the dribble, create penetration, and get a good shot for himself with his elite finishing, or create one for others. That's where he really shines, and he showed it in countless playoff series. And that's why I think he's a ceiling raiser, because he allows you to execute at a higher level and hit those tough shots when those tough shots matter and become good shots. And I think that's why I view Kyrie as an elite ceiling raiser, and why I'm happy to have him on the team. And I didn't understand a lot of the trade Kyrie discussions once we got James Harden. I think that was just fans getting frustrated with the off-court stuff.
Do you feel like that sort of naturally lends itself to a slightly different role for him and James, like, I guess, down the stretch versus other times in games and things like that?
Well, yeah, and to your point earlier, James Harden has shown in the three games that he's played with the Nets that he's the best passer on the team by far. And I don't think that's disputable. If anybody feels differently, come at me. The passes that he makes are so much fun to watch. He's seen players before they're open and throwing the ball in space and they're running to it. He's passing guys open that don't know that they're about to get open. He's making elite reads on the pick and roll where he's bouncing it between his legs and it's going right up into their hands. They're able to get layups with like an inch of space. And you contrast that to a guy like Kyrie Irving, who does have a lot of assists some nights, but his assists are just, they just seem more laborious or more difficult, where he's dribbling a ton, working really hard to create the penetration that he creates. When he throws the ball, he's like diving sideways. It's just a different form of offense to me, and it makes him more of a secondary creator. So if I wanted to slot Harden into any role, it would be him. My Boston accent came out there. It would be him being our primary creator. And it seems like he's been willing to sacrifice his scoring to play that role thus far. And if that continues, I think that the sky's the limit for this team once Kyrie settles back into the Robin to LeBron's Batman role. And I mean, KD's KD, right? He put up, what, 40, 13, and almost 10 assists tonight when he was not the primary ball handler. He can fit seamlessly into any offense. So I really think it's the Kyrie Harden dynamic that's going to have to fit in. And once we figure out that Harden's our point guard and Kyrie starts settling more to that off-ball role, I think it's going to be really fun.
Cool. Yeah, I think that makes sense, and I totally agree. I think your point about about KD, or sorry, about Kyrie as sort of a ceiling raiser, I think that kind of lends itself to being the secondary creator. And I think the key is just him being, I think, as, you know, comfortable with the off ball role, and sort of the second option is maybe not the way to put it, but I guess, you know, starting a lot of offensive, or at least, you know, him sort of taking his turn in a lot of offensive sets, not as the primary, you know, initiator of the offense, but sort of, you know, out of a scramble situation. So I think that makes sense. I have full faith that this offense is going to be fine. I think, frankly, like, they should have been fine tonight if they had made shots at the rate that they're, you know, typically making. They would have won the game in regulation. I mean, to be honest, if there wasn't that bunk-ass call, offensive foul that somehow resulted in a you know, half court jump ball, they very easily could have won. So, you know, it is what it is. You know, it would mean a lot to me if they could pull out one of these games where they just utterly suck and you know, finally sort of like pick it up in the fourth quarter to come back instead of just losing that. Like this is very reminiscent to me of the Charlotte game, just in terms of, you know, the team is at full strength and they just didn't play well. They turned the ball over. They didn't shoot particularly well. And they got into a hole. But I think the other thing that you see with this team, go ahead.
I was just like, we just have to be patient and give it time. I mean, at the beginning of the season, we were saying, hey, look how long it took the Heatles to gel. It took them 17 games to start looking like a cohesive team. That clock just restarted for the Nets. Tonight was the first game where we had our three superstars on the court together. It might be another 20 games based on our rest schedule, based on their propensity to get injured, before these guys get into any semblance of a rhythm. And hell, it might be longer than that because they're not going to practice. So I think it's going to be a long road to that. And I think there's going to be some frustration for Nets fans, especially in closer games, because we just don't have a cohesive offense yet. But that being said, with Kyrie being the forgotten man and defense is really clamping in on KD and Harden in the clutch, I think we're going to see him be the bailout guy and really make some clutch plays. I mean, hell, we saw him sneak in for an offensive rebound and a putback, some tap outs. I think that fans are really going to fall in love with how sneaky he is at the end of games because he's not the main focus of the defense. So those are two things that I see happening.
No, that totally makes sense, and I'm excited for it. And I guess, like, the other piece, or sort of the segue that I was going to make to the other sort of narrative around this team is, you know, part of, I think, why, even with their offense being as potent as it is, part of why they struggle when they get down 10 points is just that they're not necessarily able to generate the stops. Their defense seems really just sort of, hey, eventually you're going to miss. And, you know, we'll do a decent enough job on the glass to you know, get the ball back and take advantage of that because our offense will be good enough. But I think if you contrast sort of like the Bucks game where, you know, it was basically trading possessions back and forth, but the Nets were able to just score more per possession essentially down the stretch. I mean, like those two big threes where the Bucks were matching, you know, with 2-point baskets on the other end were good examples. Tonight it was, you know, trying to dig yourself out of a hole that way though, I think is very difficult. And the reason that that's hard is just not being able to generate stops on the defensive end. And so I guess, like, you know, we talked a little bit about this before the season and the two questions with defense are sort of, okay, how good is good enough? And that's going to be determined by the offense. And then how do the Nets get there? And what is sort of their ceiling with the personnel that they have currently? And I guess I'll bring that question back now that the personnel is different. So I guess, like, where do we want to start on the defensive end? Like, what, do you want to start with rotations? Do you want to start with the center position, which I think is obviously sort of like the key question mark, or do you want to start with what the theoretical ceiling could be?
I just don't know what we do with the center position, so I'd like to start there because you could – yeah, I'm sure you want to focus on the buyout market and who we could pick up there, potential trades that we have. I just don't know if there's that perfect piece out there that's going to not make that a glaring hole for us. I think we're going to be playing matchups in our crunch time lineup at the center position all year, even after we pick up a couple players or Mark's Wizards himself into – a few moves. What are your thoughts?
So let me answer with a couple questions.
Please.
I guess like step one is like, what do you think of Reggie Perry? And you know, sort of longer term fit, and then like, how long are you comfortable sort of using him as like a, giving him stopgap minutes, essentially, like he's getting right now?
Well, let me put it this way. Best case scenario for the Nets are us being able to use our final three roster spots to shore up our wing defense and maybe bring in a couple other shooters or another offensive creator to take the load off of the big three so they don't have to play 40 minutes a game. But that would entail Nick Claxton coming back and being able to play a Jared Allen level role where he can not only protect the rim, but he can jump out onto the perimeter and tread water with guys out there and stay with them to the rim and recover enough to block and make smart rotations. And for a second year player that's been injured for most of his career, that showed slight flashes last season, that is going to be a really, really difficult task. The path to getting there is tough, but that would be freaking awesome if he came back and we suddenly had this three-headed matchup monster at center where, okay, cool, let's throw DeAndre Jordan out there if we're going to treat Giannis like Shaq and not guard him past beyond 5 feet from the basket. Let's throw him out there against Embiid. Let's throw Claxton out there for playing the Pacers and you've got Miles Turner, or if you're playing the Celtics and you've got Daniel Tice or Robert Williams out there that aren't necessarily going to be big-bodied post-up guys. And then Reggie Perry is the bench guy to give those guys a couple minutes to rest during the game. And I don't think Perry is bad. I think he's held his own when he's been out there, but I don't necessarily see him being a super meaningful part of this rotation beyond maximum 10 minutes a game at some point.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, I guess like part of the question is, so, and I was trying to look it up while you were talking, just in terms of when, I think it's like within the next 2 weeks, they have to fill at least two of those roster spots. And they can fill them with 10-day contracts, but
right. Yeah. We're going to keep pushing the cart down the road there. I think we're going to hold out and really see what materializes. And the reason I think that is because our window is theoretically so small with these three players, it could potentially be a 2-year window. And that's it. So I think we really need to figure out what type of players we need on this roster and either make marginal moves to bring them in, maybe sacrifice a couple of second round picks because Lord knows we don't have any firsts, and some contracts like Dinwiddie's. Or we really hope the buyout market gets good. But I think we're going to be very, very careful with who we end up bringing into this team. It's not going to be, hey, let's try to get Jamal Crawford a ring.
Yeah, well, I mean, with that name specifically, you be careful what you wish for.
God.
So I guess just like let's focus on center for a second here, and we don't necessarily have to talk in specifics because I think I agree with you in the sense that I don't think that there's a perfect solution out there.
I
think, you know, when you're talking about buyout guys and stuff like that, like if it was a more perfect solution, they wouldn't be getting bought out. So I guess just in terms of like player archetype, like are you thinking that the Nets want to go after somebody who is sort of similar in player type to DeAndre Jordan? Do you want to try to find somebody that's a little bit more, I guess, like athletic at the expense of maybe, you know, post defense that can, you know, provide some lateral movement and rim protection? Like JaVale McGee would come to mind there. I think Dwayne Dedman might fit a little bit more in that category, although I don't know. Or are you looking for, like, you know, I've heard them connected to sort of like Tyson Chandler, which I feel like would be a little bit, you know, do you like DeAndre Jordan but wish he was older? Do you have thoughts there in terms of how that would work? Or I guess like maybe another way to phrase the question, and I apologize for thinking out loud here to you, is like, are the Nets better off with another backup center or another Jeff Green, or are those two things not mutually exclusive?
I think we're better off with another Jeff Green, especially if you look at the options out there. I've been thinking this through, and there are some fun scenarios out there. For example, the Nets finally win a title with a Lopez on the roster, but it's not Brooke, and Robin gets his ultimate revenge. I mean, how much fun would that be? to much to some Nets fans lament, but that doesn't really solve many problems for us. And listen, maybe it gives us better offensive rebounding than DeAndre Jordan gives us. Maybe it gives us a bit younger and a bit better post defense, but there's not too much of an uptick there. You know, hell, maybe the Raptors continue their slide and there's some way we trade for Aaron Baines' $7 million contract. I don't know. There just doesn't seem to be a great option there. So I think I would rather try to find another Jeff Green, somebody that can shoot, maybe play a little small ball five, defend at a little bit of a high level, and allow the Nets to play their best offensive lineups without taking too much off the table defensively. Because, hell, how did we get back into this game tonight after playing lackadaisically for 3.5 quarters? We threw in the small ball lineup, and we did just enough on defense and outshot them.
Yeah, no, I think that's a good point. I mean, that's been sort of my lean as well. And I wonder, too, like, if – I mean, do you – because the other challenge would be if you brought in Robin Lopez, let's say, and he's backing up DeAndre Jordan, like, you know, are you but we're acknowledging that sort of that small ball lineup is maybe the Nets' most effective unit. Like, what sort of help do you get? I mean, I guess it's one thing if it's insurance against sort of DeAndre just being completely incapable, which is maybe worth exploring. But it's another if it's like you're trying to get another big in the rotation because you don't feel like you're getting enough from what you have, because I think you might be better off exploring, you know, lineups where you have Jeff Green at like the nominal center position alongside KD, and you bring in, you know, a wing defender who can't shoot. So Andre Roberson or Iman Shumpert or Rondé or somebody like that, you know, might give you a little bit more defensive versatility, while, you know, creating similar difficulties on offense probably doesn't help you against the glass. But to me, I think that's a little bit more interesting, although you don't necessarily have to, like, you could bring in one of each.
I mean, there were a couple other names that I bounced around at the center. I was trying to make the center position work. I was looking at the teams that are at the bottom of their conferences without much hope of getting better. And like, maybe you could try to bring in a Jonas Valanciunas, but God, his contract is $14 million. That's a lot. You'd really be putting all your chips in to get him. Is Bismack Biyombo going to get bought out? Maybe we bring in big business after that one great playoff performance. He's been living off that for years. I was even looking at Michael Carter Williams. I mean, he's 6'6", tall enough to fit into some sort of small ball lineup out there. And again, you can slot anybody next to our guys. It's slim pickings right now.
Yeah, I was I'm trying to find the dude's name on Twitter that put together a really good list of just buyout candidates. Noah Vonleh was another guy I was thinking of, just like somebody in that sort of tweener power forwardy type mold that, you know, could switch
bad.
A little bit on defense.
Oh man, we would resurrect that guy's career. Can you imagine? He'd get a huge contract based on being a small ball five for the Nets.
Yeah, I mean, I think it would be an opportunity, and I do think they're going to win the buyout market. So I think that's the other piece of the dance, too, is like, you know, what current free agents do we want to look into, sort of knowing that somebody's going to get bought out, and, you know, that's going to be the best. I mean, buyouts are going to be the best opportunities to add to this team.
Yeah, you want to play a meaningful role on a contender. Also, and that is a great point. Thank you for bringing that up. I wanted to talk about that earlier. How do Nets fans feel about KD as GM now? There was a lot of talk after our offseason about how KD failed. He couldn't bring in players. We were promised that players would sign for less to come play with the Nets. KD was playing chess while we were playing checkers, and he brought us James Harden. And now we get to see him attract players on the fringes once the buyout market starts solidifying. That's KD's GM.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it just, like, the other thing was, you know, when you saw like Ibaka sign elsewhere, or Nick Batum, I mean, like, both of those guys would actually be super useful now. But I think part of it was at the time when we had Jared Allen here and we had the roster that we had, like, it's just hard to find a to carve a role out for somebody like that when they're competing against, you know, so many different bodies and so many different young players. And so now I think, you know, the opportunity that you're granting is like there are real playoff minutes to be had here in the front court. And because that front court depth is thin, like I think it's funny that teams or like the, you know, another piece of the narrative sort of surrounding this team is like, oh, the depth is taking such a huge hit, and it has, but like really just the front court depth, like really specifically just the center position,
right?
And really specifically because you don't think that DeAndre Jordan is an NBA player anymore. Like the backcourt depth is fine. I mean, you've got Tyler Johnson, who's not getting run. You've got, you know, Bruce Brown, who's playing minimal minutes. You've got Landry Shamet, who didn't play tonight. Like, you have plenty of guys to toggle in at guard. So, you know, it's really just a question of, like, shoring up the front court and figuring out how to make that work.
Well, that I think that's going to be the biggest tell on what the Nets think of DeAndre Jordan. Because if we do bring in a Robin Lopez type, that tells me that they don't believe that DeAndre Jordan is going to be able to play meaningful clutch minutes or even meaningful full game playoff minutes for the Nets. And they're looking for a way to bring in another bruiser who can compete against those bigger teams. So I think there's going to be a lot of tells as to what they think of the players at the positions that they backfill on the current roster based on who they bring in.
Yeah. It's going to be interesting.
Also,
I guess, like,
go ahead.
No, finish that.
I was gonna say I'm also are we entirely convinced that the Nets didn't put together a conspiracy to get together and get their buddy Jeff Green one final large contract? Because this guy is gonna look so good for the rest of the season, having the worst possible defender on him, wide open threes, and being part of our best lineups as a small ball five. I mean, he's been getting minimum contracts for the past 4 to 5 years. He could play himself into something nice on this team.
Yeah, I mean, at this point, like, I don't know that the Nets can afford to lose him, so.
Yeah, maybe
he might get that nice contract from Jim Stein.
maybe we're screwing ourselves.
I mean, you're just screwing Josiah's pocketbook, which is, you know, I think.
We're pulling Tobias Funke. We blew ourselves.
Fine with it. Yeah, it's and then I think, you know, not to get too far ahead of ourselves either, but like then you wonder, you know, does that principle of like what you expected to happen this past offseason, does that then happen next offseason, where like are you able to get, you know, guys to come for the taxpayer mid level that would potentially sign for more elsewhere that would make a ton of sense? Because I do think that role will be available here.
That's a good
unless
question.
They totally nail it. But like somebody like Thaddeus Young, who's going to be a free agent, you know, is there an opportunity to, you know, bring him in at like a 3-year, $50 million contract or something to be a second Jeff Green? Because I think he'd be a fantastic second Jeff Green.
I think you're right. I think we just need to not look like a dumpster fire in the playoffs and all of that will fall into place.
Yeah.
Huh.
Well, it'll be interesting. It'll be interesting to see, I think, what those marginal moves are now. I do think you're probably too far out to really know, but
yeah,
I do think, you know, we'll see some 10 days soon.
Yeah, did we bring in a backup Jeff Green or did we bring in a backup DeAndre Jordan? Very interested to see.
I think I got my sort of money is on like Iman Shumpert, like an Iman Shumpert type coming in. Like a guy who I think would still be in the league if he could shoot, can't shoot. And, you know, well, what's a good antidote for that? We'll try playing in a lineup that, you know, can just scorch like four of the best 3-point shooters of all time surrounding you.
Yeah, hell, throw Richard Jefferson in there. He's still playing beach volleyball.
He was fantastic on the call tonight, by the way.
Oh, he was great.
calling out Torian Prince when he just like all of a sudden decided to like, oh yeah, I can shoot again. Which was hilarious. And also the, I don't know if you caught it, but Ian Eagle deferring to him to describe Jeff Green taking a nut shot was pretty excellent. Peabody award winning journalism right there.
Do you have a medical background, Richard?
Well, and then coming in being like, I wasn't going to touch it.
Oh, man. It was great. Torrey and Prince quickly finding out that shots come with a little less pressure in Cleveland, Ohio.
Yeah, but, you know, you do have to then continue shooting them in Cleveland.
That is
so
true.
That's a bummer. I was once again reminded of one of my favorite quotes from my philosopher king, Ichiro Suzuki, who said that if he ever found himself, what is it? The actual quote: "To tell you the truth, I'm not excited to go to Cleveland, but we have to. If I ever saw myself saying I'm excited to go to Cleveland, I'd punch myself in the face because I'm lying." So I don't think that Steve Nash is going to make this team run suicides, but I do know for a fact he's going to make them stay in Cleveland until Saturday, and that is the worst punishment of all.
Oh, we have to, steam over our loss until Friday.
Can we talk about what the fuck they're doing with fans in the arena there? Like, get out of here, yeah, you psychopaths.
I saw Larry Nance gesturing to the crowd. I'm like, yep, and thank God it was Inauguration Day.
And you'll be dead soon, which in fairness, you won't be in Cleveland. So, well, I think we got salty, which is good because I've been having a great day. I don't know, Brett, do we have more stuff we want to cover here, or do we cut ourselves off at under an hour for the first time ever?
Dude, I think we loop, swoop, and pull it, as Adam Sandler and Big Daddy would say, and we come back, and once we have a strong enough sample size, we can really start making some inferences about this defense and what type of player can help out.
Well, our next pod is going to be the emergency pod when we sign Jamal Crawford, so I can stick it in your eye.
So you can shove that in my face. Oh, I'm not looking forward to that. He's making the podcast too. He's putting his name out there. I'm available.
I mean, listen, I love Jamal Crawford. Don't get me wrong. I just...
How can you not?
I think, there's better use of, particularly on this team, I think there's better use of roster constraints. Hey, let me just while we're getting dark here for a second, let me leave you with a question that I have been pondering.
No.
If Brett, Spencer Dinwiddie had not torn his ACL.
Stop.
I got two what ifs for you. If Spencer Dinwiddie had not torn his ACL, do you think that there is a world in which the James Harden trade could have been reworked to be LeVert, Caruso, and Dinwiddie, not Prince, and not Allen?
Oh, yes, I do. Yes, and I've thought about that.
I feel like from the Rockets' perspective, they would not have wanted Dinwiddie because he has a player option for next year. So he's not guaranteed to be off their books. And they seem to want picks more than a player. But
look at the first they took back. They took back Milwaukee's first. That's basically a second round pick. We could have found a team that was willing to take Dinwiddie and pass over a pick.
Right. Well, so that was what I was going to say. Like I think you get the Milwaukee pick because you traded Allen and Prince. So it's like, not to be too like reductionist about it, but like, you know, I feel like you could have probably gotten a better first for Allen if you weren't packaging him with Prince. So if you're just trading Dinwiddie for a pick in this scenario, I feel like you could probably get a better pick than they ended up getting. And the money doesn't work great, but it's not that bad. Well, and you could also throw in like a Shamet or a TLC or somebody in there to ballast the salaries a little bit.
I certainly think that we could have made that happen. I think we would have made that happen, considering we were bringing back one of the best offensive creators of all time.
So question number two for you. If the Nets had kept the 19th pick and taken Sadiq Bey, who is currently tracking towards tying the record for rookie three-point percentage, fun trivia question, Brett. Do you know who holds the record for rookie 3-point percentage?
Oh no.
Or I don't know. I don't know if it's the record. I may have to look this one up to clarify what this stat is that I'm referring to. Hold, please. Or don't hold. Think about it. Think out loud. Actually, would be better for our listeners.
It would be.
Also, we're totally going over an hour.
Oh, for sure. It would be too poetic if it was Landry Shamet.
It is Landry Shamet.
I knew it! I knew it!
It is Landry Shamet. 2018-19. Oh, sorry. I think it is the record. It's basically rookies who have shot over 40% on five attempts per game. 2018-19, Landry Shamet shot 42% from three on 5% or five attempts per game, becoming the first rookie to shoot 40% or better from three while getting up at least 3-point shots or at least five 3-point shots per game. Excuse me, I can't read. Sadiq Bey is currently or was currently as of January 16th shooting 42.6% from three. So, question to you. If we had kept that young man instead of trading that pick for Landry Shamet, do you think that he either could have been accepted as a first round pick because he was recently drafted, he's on a rookie contract and he's been playing well? I mean, I guess a little bit more Heisenberg uncertainty principle with this particular line of thinking, because like, would he have been getting the minutes to show off?
Right. Yeah. What he has been played for the Nets.
Probably not. But he was a fairly coveted prospect. Like, he fits a role. I mean, I think you can make a strong argument that you'd just rather have him than Shamet, period. But in terms of including in this deal, like, do you think that there's a world where that allows them to keep Allen? You could keep Prince in the deal at that point, but where Bay would allow them to keep Allen instead of Shamet?
It's tough because how many championship teams have players that young playing meaningful minutes for them? And
yeah, I don't know.
I mean, I think the point about him not getting burned is the biggest one, because when he's going to play is going to be the regular season. And there's a chance that could have happened, but hell, look how long it took Bruce Brown to get minutes on this team.
That's true. I think the other thing to keep in mind too, is like with the way those negotiations seem to go, like the Nets were pretty like pretty much gave everything that they possibly could into that deal.
Yeah.
And so at some point, like, is the ask going to be equivalent value, or is the ask going to be everything that you possibly can? In which case Jared Allen gets thrown in, you're just giving a better package. So I don't know that it's necessarily fair to assume that that would have worked better. It's just, I personally think this team with Harden, if we had Jared Allen, I think they would be an Eastern Conference favorite right now, no alterations needed. Whereas I think they're probably a guy away, and you still probably would have been able to get that same guy. If that makes sense.
I think Tillman Fertitta just told Joe Tsai and Sean Marks to shut up and listen. Which is his
Tillman Fertitta.
Tillman Fertitta, spend your money. You know, that's a book that he wrote, right? It's called Shut Up and Listen, Hard Business Truths That Will Help You Succeed. He wrote this right before he groveled at Donald Trump's feet and asked him for a handout.
I did not know that, but now I do. So that's awesome. So anyway, I think we've probably exhausted our listeners' attention spans. Brett, do you want to tell the people where they can find us on the inner tubes?
They can find us on the dredges of the inner tubes. They can find us on Twitter at Russell and Fro. You can email us russellandfro@gmail.com. We still have netspulse@gmail.com as well. You can listen to our podcast on pretty much any podcast medium that's out there. I really don't know of one that you wouldn't be able to listen to us on. Throw Breaker out there, throw Stitcher out there, throw Apple Podcasts, Spotify. You can listen to us on my phone. I don't know what my dad listens to us on, but I'm sure it's neither of those apps, and it's probably something riddled with viruses. There's just a lot of options out there.
You're better than my dad, who listened to 10 minutes and said, you know, this is not for me.
Not for me. Not for me.
No, thank you.
Not you.
I guess as we'll sign off with a shout out to Bernie Sanders.
Hello, Brooklyn. If we had a daughter, guess what I'ma call her? Brooklyn Carter. When I left you for Virginia, it didn't offend you, cause you know I only stepped out to get dinner. Hello, Brooklyn.
How you doing?
That's right back.